I read 1.1-1. I think it's in the mid-90s. I read it. It says Section 1 of the Code imposes an income tax on the income of every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States. Now, if you don't notice anything about that, because I didn't, it just blew me away. It says every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States. Now, we just got through looking at Section 9-11. What does the Secretary of the Treasury seem like they're talking about when they're talking about an individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States? And if you look very carefully at that definition of qualified individual, just to play along with me, it says means, number one, an individual whose tax homes in a foreign country. And look at that phrase, who is, and who is a citizen or resident of the United States. So qualified individual, if we read that in conjunction with 1.1-1A, it sure seems to be the specific definition that is not in the Title Y definition. It happens to be, for purposes of this section, Section 9-11. And so with that, I would just suggest that this is how carefully we have to read these definitions and these special words, terms of art, all of these words that Congress and the Secretary uses. There's no mistake. I mean, every single one of these definitions, every single word that they use, they know exactly what they want that word to mean. In fact, if you look at the definition of individual, I would say, why don't you just write this down and look it up yourself? It's in the regulations under 26 CFR. It's in the Code of Federal Regulations, Section 1.1441-1, and it's a little c in parentheses. That's the definitions. It's found in 1.1441-1. C3 is the definition of an individual. So look that up and let's talk about that next time. So Joe, let's move on to the next topic. Go back to where were we at on this?
7701.
Yeah, 7701. We got, if you go over to, scroll down to B, which is at past 48. I'm going to scroll down past 48. There it is right there. Now they're giving us the Title Y definition of a resident alien, and then B1B is a non-resident alien. Because when you're reading 1.1-1A, it says, you know, the code imposes a tax on the income of every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States, and to the extent provided in 871B and 877B, the income of a non-resident alien individual. So B, capital B, non-resident alien, and they say that an individual is a non-resident alien if such individual is neither a citizen of the United States nor a resident of the United States within the meaning of subparagraph A. Subparagraph A is directly above defining a resident alien. A resident alien is treated no differently than a U.S. person, citizen of the United States. In fact, if we look at the definition of United States person, Congress says citizen or resident of the United States. A resident alien is the character that Congress was talking about. So that pretty much takes care of what I have to say, Joe and Larry and John, folks.
Very good. Sean, you want to jump in?
Okay. Well, everything that Joe, or rather Larry and Gary are telling you, as you follow along with the documents that are being presented, show you what the law is. They're not making it up. They're spelling it spelled out right there for you to see how Congress wrote it, how they went back and forth to make sure it was as complicated as it could possibly be. But nevertheless, it is what it is. That's what it is. A lot of these arguments have been advanced one way or the other before the Internal Revenue Service court, tax court, and administrative procedures. And many of these issues, such as Gary is explaining and Larry has explained, the IRS simply doesn't like it. So what does government do with something they don't like? Well, they have to do one of two things with it. They either have to address it and explain why the argument is wrong and justify their explanation, or they have to explain why the government is right and we're completely wrong and not justify their explanation. And they do that, the second one they do, simply by saying, we've taken a look at one of your issues here. For example, the fact that the income tax is based upon voluntary compliance, and we've decided it's frivolous. Now that we've made that determination, we're going to move along. That's basically what they do with every argument that has any legal power and any legal consequences to what the IRS is doing with the income tax today. They basically sit, they being the courts and the IRS, get together and decide, we're just going to declare it frivolous and that's the way it's going to be. Well, they've done us a great favor here. Back in the early 2000s, I believe it was, the IRS put together a document called The Truth About Frivolous Tax Arguments. That's what they call it, The Truth About Frivolous Tax Arguments. Keep in mind, this is their truth. I hear this a lot on Fox, for example, when they have people on. One person will get on and tell you, well, this is the truth, and then the next person sitting beside will say, well, no, this is the truth. So I guess everybody in this day and age, they have their own truth. But in fact, there's only one truth. And that is what the law is, and that's what it is. No matter how you want to spin it, no matter how you want to play with it, no matter how you want to ignore it, the truth is what it is. So what I'm going to do is deal with a couple of issues right now regarding this document that the IRS put out, called The Truth About Frivolous Tax Arguments. The IRS document in and of itself, the last one that I have is dated January 2010, and it's 83 pages long. It took 83 pages to try to explain to you why almost every argument that's ever been brought before them is frivolous for one reason or the other, and then they give you their explanation of why it's frivolous. Then they cite you to court cases that they believe explain why the arguments are frivolous, and the IRS then relies upon these court cases. The problem is once you start going through this government document about the truth about frivolous tax arguments, you find out that when the government doesn't, or the IRS rather, we'll try to stick with the IRS, when the IRS doesn't like the question you pose to it, they rearrange the question the way they want it, the way they like it, and then they answer it. Which, gee, I wish I could do that when I don't like the question, but then they answer the question that they pose, and then they give you the authority they believe they have to back up the answer they've given you to the question that they proposed. It's a good little scam, and this is what they've done with the truth about frivolous tax arguments. Now, as Larry said from the beginning, and I agree 100%, there are a lot of frivolous tax arguments. And even in this document that I've read, I've seen several frivolous tax arguments. I think the arguments may have had merit had the argument really actually been advanced with legal authority, and the argument would have been logically presented rather than from a point-and-shoot attitude where some of these people have presented these cases. And, you know, a lot of these cases that were formed and a lot of these issues were brought by people that didn't really study the law, and I'm just not talking about attorneys or paralegals or individuals, but people that really didn't study the law. They just simply picked up something, and they read it and said, wow, I'm going to court and I'm going to win. I'm going to say, for example, these aren't income. That's the end of the argument. And then they go in court and find out there was a lot more to the argument that they haven't considered, but they don't understand it because they didn't really study the law. And they don't understand how they could have lost the argument. And as a result of that, a lot of bad case law has been achieved over the last 30 years or better.
Hey, Sean, your audio kind of went down a little bit.
Okay, let me see what I can do about that. Is that any better?
Yeah, it's a lot better.
Okay. So, out of this 81 pages of the IRS put together. I put together a rebuttal to their so-called truth about frivolous tax arguments. And I'm going to touch on a couple of them because we don't have a lot of time. There's a 39-page rebuttal here. If you ever decide you want to take a look at it, it's been posted on my website. But when you read it for the value it's put there, and then go research. Go research the cases. Don't take it and go out and file a lawsuit. That would be a bad idea. Don't take it and go to the IRS and say, well, this is just the way it is. Not unless you've studied every one of these issues yourself and you know that what you're reading is the truth and not something someone else wrote. In other words, you have to understand what it is you're reading and you have to understand why what you're reading happens to have a basis in statutory law and in case law. Anyway, one of the most popular arguments that the IRS has addressed, which is still to this day, is a popular argument, and I think it's a correct argument too, and that is the voluntary nature of the federal income tax. We've had IRS commissioners tell us that the income tax system is based upon voluntary compliance. We've had the courts tell us that the income tax system is based upon voluntary compliance. IRS does it in their publications and in their instructions. It's based upon voluntary compliance. In one publication, the IRS actually told you at one time that you must decide if you have to file an income tax return. Not your lawyer, not a CPA, not the IRS, but you must decide. Once that was pointed out, I believe they finally did take that out. I guess it's voluntary and we must decide, but they have a funny way with this word voluntary. Here's their position in their truth about frivolous income tax issues. Here's their contention in their opinion. It states, some taxpayers assert that they are not required to file federal tax returns because the filing of a tax return is voluntary. Well, gee, I think that makes sense. Required and voluntary in the same system or a sentence seems to be a dichotomy. They just don't seem to go together. But anyway, that's their first statement. Proponents of this contention point to the fact that the IRS itself tells taxpayers in the form 1040 instruction book that the tax system is voluntary. Well, they're right about that too. The IRS tells us that. And now they're telling us they don't want us to believe them. Additionally, the IRS says, the Supreme Court's opinion in Florida versus United States is often quoted for the proposition that our system of taxation is based upon voluntary assessment and payment, not upon restraint. Well, the IRS is correct in everything they're saying so far. Now, here's their opinion. This is the IRS's opinion of what they have just told you. The word voluntary, they say, as used in FLORA and in IRS publications, refers to our system of allowing taxpayers to determine the correct amount of tax and complete the appropriate returns rather than have the government determine tax for them. What? It's voluntary because we're allowed to figure out how to read, understand, and fill in an income tax form. We're allowed then to complete the form, assuming that we've convinced ourselves we understand what we're reading in their booklet of instructions. And then we're allowed to determine our tax. And based upon the fact that we're allowed to do this, the system is voluntary. They go on to say, however, the requirement to file an income tax return. Now, just remember, they just got done telling you it was voluntary, okay? They go on to say, the requirement to file an income tax return is not voluntary and is clearly set forth in Internal Revenue Code sections 6011, 6012, 6072, and Treasury Regulation 1.6011-1. So here we've got the IRS telling you that, well, we've told you in the publications, our publications is voluntary. The Supreme Court's told you it's based on voluntary compliance and self-assessment. We're saying that it's voluntary to the extent we're going to allow you to prepare your own returns and decide how much you owe, and God help you if you're wrong. But you're really required to do it. They go on to explain, any taxpayer who has received more than statutorily determined amount of gross income, we'll be talking about this, is obligated to file a return. Failure to file a tax return could subject the non-compliant individual, there's that term individual, to criminal penalties, including fines, imprisonment, as well as civil penalties. Then they cite a case that said, in United States versus Tedder, the court clearly states, although Treasury regulations establish voluntary compliance as a general method of income tax collection, Congress gave the Secretary of the Treasury the power to enforce the income tax laws through the involuntary collection. Okay, how do we resolve this? That part of it's voluntary, but part of it's not voluntary. I'd submit to you that maybe they're half right and half wrong. It's voluntary if you're not required to file a return, but you file a return anyway, whether it's through mistake or you believe that you're required to file a return, it's absolutely voluntary. It's not voluntary, on the other hand, if the income tax as it's being applied is being applied to you correctly and it places you within the orbit of the law and shows that you indeed are an individual or a person or a citizen under the Internal Revenue Code, which requires you to file a return based upon the fact that you've been made liable for a tax based upon the taxable income that you may have earned. Then I'd say it's probably not voluntary. But if all of those elements are not met, then if you file a return and you're not required to do it, it's voluntary. If you're paying a tax that you're not required to pay, it's voluntary. If you are not made liable for the income tax and you decide to pay it anyway, it's absolutely voluntary. So maybe this is how they resolve what appears to be a dichotomy here. If that isn't the resolution, then I don't know how the IRS can say on the one hand, it's voluntary, except we're kidding. We're just telling you that. Well, that's a good question. Why are they telling you that? And why do the courts tell you that? Here's the rebuttal, parts of the rebuttal that was written to the address this question. First, it goes like this. The IRS admits the case of Florida versus U.S. is often quoted for the proposition that a system of taxation is based upon voluntary assessment and payment and not upon the straight. They tell you that simply because it's a true statement and they can't avoid it. Also, the IRS recognizes the fact that the IRS tells taxpayers in the Form 1040 instruction booklet that the tax system is voluntary. But then they continue with the absurd logic that the word voluntary does not mean voluntary, but rather the requirement file return is not voluntary and set forth in the code sections that I previously told you about, 6011, 6012, 6072. So let's take a look at those sections briefly. Section 6011, it does not require you to file a tax return unless there's a liability. But even then, the section itself, 6011, does not identify a tax return for you to file. But it does say one thing, that if you have been made liable for a tax under the income tax laws, you are required to file a return and provide information. So before the act, which is necessary before you are required to file a return, is that somewhere in the law, you had to have been made liable for the tax. Section 6001 does not accomplish that. And they go on to say that, well, you know, it falls under the requirement to file a return would arise under regulations. And that's what it says. 6001 starts out when required by regulations, as many, many of the statutes do. So let's go to one of the regulations. Regulation 26 CFR 6001.602, Tax Forms Instruction, states the following. The tax system is based on voluntary compliance and the taxpayers complete and return the forms with payment of any tax owed. That's what the regulation says. It's voluntary again. So now we have the courts, you have the IRS, their booklets, their instructions, now their regulations telling you that the tax system is based on voluntary compliance. And if you decide to volunteer because you're not required, then you file a return, admit to a tax liability. If you're going to admit to a tax liability, you have made yourself liable for it by saying, I owe this much tax, signing the return under a penalty of perjury. You self-impose the tax on yourself, and you self-impose the liability on yourself when you file the return. That's why they need the return. But it's voluntary. Remember, you don't have to do it unless law requires you to do it. 6011 does not accomplish that unless you have been made liable somewhere in the Internal Revenue Code for the tax. We discussed this several weeks ago about various sections of the Internal Revenue Code, such as Section 5001 regarding distilled spirits and how a tax is imposed upon the distilled spirits, and 6505, which I believe deals with the manufacturing of tobacco, that's distilled spirits also. But what happens here is under those two statutes, one imposes the tax on the liquor, the other one makes the manufacturer liable for it. The income tax imposes a tax on taxable income. That's what Section 1 of the Internal Revenue Code does. It imposes a tax on taxable income. But it never, ever tells you in that section that you're liable for the tax. It tells you in no section through the Internal Revenue Code that you, as a citizen of the United States, are liable for this income tax. So absence the liability, where does the requirement to file a return come in? According to the Internal Revenue Service, it's Section 6001. But Section 6001 says no, not unless you're liable. The next section that they dealt with is Section 6012. That doesn't create a liability for payment of an income tax either. It merely states that every individual having for, there's that word again, every individual. Every individual having for the taxable year gross income which equals or exceeds the exemption amount, well, there you go. First, you have to be, as I said before, you have to have been made liable for the tax. Then it has to have been imposed on upon the taxable gross income of an individual. You know, they're not getting to citizen here, which is also dealt with in this memorandum. We won't get to it tonight, unfortunately, maybe another time. But there's a lot of elements here missing as to why you would be required under Section 6012 to file a return in the absence of a liability or in the absence of you being the individual a tax has been imposed upon. Remember, under 6001, it doesn't impose a tax on an individual. It imposes a tax on the taxable income of an individual. And finally, the Internal Revenue Service relies on Section 6702. And this deals with the time and place that a return should be voluntarily filed. And over the years, I, as prosecutors, federal prosecutors actually, have developed new theories to combat the absolute clarity of the law, to explain to us why what the law says isn't really what it means. And here's one of the ones they introduced some time ago. The IRS and federal prosecutors began to introduce a new idea that somehow Section 1, and as I previously mentioned, creates liability to file a return. No, it doesn't. Go read Section 1 for yourself. Part of it is reproduced in this rebuttal, but pull out the Internal Revenue Code. Read Section 1. When you find out where it makes you liable or it makes anybody liable, write me. I'd like to know. In pertinent part, here's what Section 1 says.
Hey, Sean, can I say something here?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, you know, on that point, there are three elements for tax. There's the imposition of the tax. There's the rate. The third element is making somebody liable. So in Section 1, you have the taxes imposed upon taxable income. And of course, Section 1 also includes blooming rate.
Yep.
And, you know, this is real important. You got to know who's liable. That's all. I just wanted to point out those three elements.
Okay. And, you know, sometime I think we've addressed the liability issue to a brief extent in the past, but I'm sure we're going to be doing it again in the future. Anyway, the IRS, when they make these statements and they come up with these ideas and these prosecutors do, they look back and they try to rely upon cases. One of the ones that they relied upon was the case called, I think it was U.S. versus Tedder, United States versus Tedder. And Tedder was a pro se litigant, untrained in the law, and he'd come up with this idea and decided to represent himself in a criminal court case, which, listen, it's not a good idea. I'm not sure that a bad attorney in a criminal case is better than no attorney at all, but if you know nothing about the law and you know even less about how to behave in court and how to move around in court and do what you're supposed to do in court, you're in for a real bad time. Anyway, he was charged with willful failure to file. And he believed that he couldn't be convicted because he had a good faith belief that the laws didn't apply to him. He didn't advance the argument about whether or not the income tax was voluntary or that he wasn't required to file a return because it was all based upon voluntary compliance. But the IRS cites that court case as though that case ended the argument that the court had decided in that particular case that this idea that it's voluntary, their voluntary compliance is moving force behind the income tax is absolutely ridiculous. In fact, they have done this with a great many cases in their frivolous tax law arguments. They have cited, there are so many, I'll read a few of them off. Hillary versus Mitchell, United States versus Gerards, United States versus Teddy, United States versus Richards, Wood versus Commissioner, United States versus Drefke, and there's many more. United States versus Schultz, Johnson versus Commissioner, and there's many, many more. But let's take a look at some of those cases and see what they really say, and if how they dealt with this idea that these cases stand for the proposition that the income taxes are based upon voluntary compliance. Now, keep in mind, they're trying to convince you through this paper in these court cases that the system, even though they tell you it's based on voluntary compliance, that it isn't. So they cite to the Helvering case. Helvering didn't deal with whether or not there was a requirement under the income tax law. And Mitchell didn't contend to the contrary. He didn't say there was no requirement. The Helvering court was dealing with tax fraud and whether or not double jeopardy attaches to the imposition of both the civil and criminal penalty in that case. The issue of whether filing an income tax return was never an issue, yet the government cites it as though somehow it dealt with that issue. In United States versus Gerard, the court did not deal with filing of a tax return, but rather the paying of a valid tax assessment. But again, the IRS cites it as though it's some kind of controlling law for the idea that they don't really believe that the Supreme Court meant it when they said the income tax system was based on voluntary compliance and self-assessment. Drefke argues that the taxes are debts which can be incurred when voluntarily when individuals contract with the government for services. And that because he refused to sign the forms, he wasn't a taxpayer, therefore it didn't pertain to him. The thing about Drefke was that it didn't address the issue of whether or not the income tax was based upon voluntary compliance. Neither did the Richard case. Neither did the Woods case. Yet the United States cites to these cases as though these are the end-all argument of the fact that, listen, even though we tell you it isn't based on voluntary compliance, these cases tell you that it isn't based on voluntary compliance. We've been lying to you. Well, they've been lying to you, all right. None of these court cases stand for the argument that the income tax is based on voluntary compliance, simply because the issue was never raised. The courts didn't have to determine it. And if the courts, if the judge made some offside comment that, well, we all know it's not based on voluntary compliance, there's a problem there, because that's all that's called is dictum. It has nothing to do with the decision the court's actually handing down, because it wasn't ever an issue before the court for them to deal with. The purpose of showing you this analysis and this rebuttal is to show you something that when the United States government, through the IRS, puts together a piece of paper called Frivolous Tax Arguments and the Truth About Them, they're not telling you the truth. They're misrepresenting not only the law, they're misrepresenting the court cases, and they're misrepresenting what the actual words of the Internal Revenue Code say to convince you that their truth is the only truth. And like I said in the beginning, there's only one truth. The government certainly has theirs, and we certainly have ours, but there's the truth, and the truth is the law. And the law isn't on the government's side. And the way they push the side of law is very simple. As Larry said, when they don't like it, they just say, it's frivolous. And it's been decided. You know, I've read a lot of court cases through what just the government's provided me. And every time they said, well, this issue of wages aren't income was decided in such and such a case, therefore we don't have to say any more about it. It's a frivolous argument. So I traced that case back, find out what happened with that case. Well, that court case pretty much said the same thing and relied upon another case from the past. So I go back and I look at that court. And that court case probably says the same thing which relied upon a case before then. Eventually, you get to a court case, that's the first court case that dealt with wages are not income, and the government is saying they are, that when you say wages aren't income, it's frivolous, and you know what the legal authority behind that for the court was? Well, the court just said it. They didn't provide any basis for it. They just said that's what it is, and that's what the code says, except that's not what the code does say. That is one example of this entire frivolous tax arguments that the Internal Revenue Service put out. There's a tremendous amount of them. And I don't think it's been updated since 2010. You might want to take a look at that document. If you can't get it, send me an email and I'll mail you the IRS's frivolous tax arguments document, and you can see. And the rebuttal, as I said, is posted on my website. But go through these and take a look at them and start comparing what the IRS says about these arguments and why they've declared them frivolous and why they think the courts have declared them frivolous. Take a look at the rebuttal and then sit down. Get out your computer, start bringing up these cases. It isn't hard anymore based upon the research capabilities of the computer. Sit down and start reading this and researching it. You're going to find out that the government has put together a whole lot of lies and published it as though Moses received it from the good Lord. It just didn't happen that way. And these guys are flat lying to you. Like I said, there are some of these arguments that they have in here that I'd say they were frivolous because of the way they were advanced, the position the person was taking, and there was really no background for the law behind them. But for the preponderance of these arguments that the IRS has said they're frivolous and they're without merit and they've been decided, that simply isn't the truth. And again, we're running out of time here. And we'll go back to these frivolous tax arguments again, because there's a lot of them to cover. And we want you folks also to take a look at them to determine for yourself, is the government lying? Are we not telling you the truth? Or is the law really what the law says it is? Keep in mind, there's a lot of political reasons to keep the income tax. There's a lot of political reasons to keep the shred up. But it doesn't change the fact that when it comes to the income tax and the application of the income tax, you've been seriously misled by the government, and it's time we wake up to it. The best way to wake up to it is take a look at the position they're taking, research it, and say, why would they tell me this when it's obviously not the truth?